Great morning, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Thank God for Monday. I'm Brother Greg Cellini of the Franciscan Brothers of Brooklyn and the Office of Mission, Ministry, and Interfaith Dialogue at St. Francis College in beautiful Brooklyn, New York. My great pleasure to be back again with you today. The purpose of our show, Thank God for Monday, is to inspire you, our audience, to take personal responsibility for your professional satisfaction. We want to provide you hope, healing, and peace in these unprecedented, turbulent, uncertain times. Motivate you to search deep inside yourself in the quest for fulfillment. Listeners, it's really up to you as to how to utilize the information we provide today. Take full accountability for the decisions you make and a resulting outcome. Now, one of the goals of our show, Thank God for Monday, is to introduce role models of people who take very bold steps in their work lives. This is a very special month, the month of February, which is designated as Black History Month. And to help us celebrate Black History Month, we have with us a very, very special guest. Her name is Fatima Gilliam, ESQ. Fatima is a lawyer, consultant, public speaker, and entrepreneur whose career combines expertise in the law, diversity, human capital, leadership, stakeholder engagement, and negotiations. She is a founder and chief executive officer of the Azara Group, which provides diversity and inclusion, leadership development, negotiation, and strategy consulting services to Fortune 500 companies, senior executives of billion-dollar businesses, and industry thought leaders. She's also an author. She's written a fantastic book entitled Race Rules: What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You. Great morning and welcome to Thank God for Monday, Fatima.
Thank
Fatima,
you so
I'm
much for
sorry, Fatima, I'll get it right yet.
Fatima. Yes. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here with you today and to share my thoughts and views and perspective with your audience.
Thank you so very much. The honor is all ours for us to have you here with us today. Come and share with the listeners and me from what city and state you're speaking from, please.
I am in the New York City tri-state area. I live in New York and I grew up in Berkeley, California.
Wow, terrific. Sadly, we've only got about 30 minutes. We're going to jump right into the deep end of the pool. You have an incredibly unique perspective as a Black woman who is often mistaken for a white person. What sorts of comments have you heard that were racist? How did you respond to them? Help us out, please.
I will say, first that when people look at me, there are a lot of misconceptions around who I am, what I am, because I have extremely light skin. If I get my hair done and it's straight and not curly, then it is very easy for people to think I'm white. People will also think that maybe once they do realize I'm Black, that one of my parents is Black. But no, both of my parents are Black. All four of my grandparents are Black, and my family has been in this country for nearly 400 years. But in
Wow.
terms of your question, what are the things that people say when they don't realize I'm Black? I mean, sometimes it's the N-word,
Oh.
yes, I mean, that has happened. Or things like Black people are lazy, Blacks have a natural propensity to commit crimes. And then on the sort of lighter fit, if they're talking about, candidates, then maybe someone's just like not a good fit for their organization. Like they're not the right culture, not sure they would mesh with the culture, and then once people do realize I'm Black, then they'll say things like, well, you don't have to say that you're Black, as if there's something negative about being Black. Or they say that I'm one of the, quote unquote, good ones because I went to Wellesley College, Harvard for my master's and Columbia Law School for my law degree. So I don't fit the stereotype of what they think Black should look like or be.
This is very disturbing to me to hear this. I'm sure to you as
But
well.
it's real. I mean, and, you know, and it's also one of the reasons why I wrote the book that I did to share information with people and my perspective.
Wow, that was going to be my next question. Maybe you can peel the onion for us a little bit more. What inspired you to write this fantastic book, Race Rules?
Yes, Race Rules, What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You. It's a very much an unvarnished truth kind of a book. It's like ripping off the Band-Aid and saying the quiet part out loud, so that people can learn and make better decisions. So the catalyst for writing Race Rules was I was watching the news 5 years ago. And so I was watching it one day, and it was another story of a Karen going viral for calling the police for no reason. And as I watched the news story, I started to think about my lived experiences, the rinse and repeat questions that people ask me in my personal and professional life or with my diversity consulting work. And then I also thought about the things that white people say around me when they don't realize I'm Black. And as the story started to unfold, I had an aha moment. And then I said to myself, oh, white people need a manual. And so that is what I've written with my book. It is a how-to guide to make better choices. It's a sort of choose your own race knowledge adventure on a broad range of topics so that people can get quick advice. Why something is problematic and how they can do better, and to encourage them to action. So if they want to understand cultural appropriation or color blindness or microaggressions or how to apologize or have better discussions around race or taking a knee, Black Lives Matter versus January 6th, voting rights restrictions, how to define racism. I mean, it's a lot of different topics. There are 31 chapters, and then it's broken down in what I call, you know, in a format for what I call the lazy reader, because I'm a lazy reader. And so, you know, for people that want to hop around or skim, it's got like translation charts. You said this, say this instead. This is why it was wrong. It has shaded boxes and beautiful, powerful illustrations. Each race rule chapter, the 31 chapters, each have a powerful, thought-provoking illustration that sort of encapsulates it. So I'm trying to meet people where they are because people don't like to take on race and racism. And, you know, people don't want it. Not everybody wants to take themselves on as a project. So I'm trying to give them complex information in accessible, digestible, in a, you know, package for them to make better decisions.
It's funny you mentioned about being a lazy reader, the Thank God for Monday listeners. I'm a terrible reader, but you've written this book in such a great way that even someone like me can digest it, follow it, and put it into action. So
Yeah, I
kudos
mean,
to you.
and I'll say this too, Greg, like what I'm trying to move people to is action, right? That is my main thing. So a lot of people will think, well, you know, I think racism is bad or discrimination is bad. You know, I'm an ally. I think that the police shouldn't be shooting people willy-nilly. You know, they may think all of that stuff, but it's like, okay, well, what are you doing about it? Or when you see discrimination, when you see injustice, what are you doing? And so what I am trying to do in this, you know, digestible format where people can hop around to the topics that they need. I'm trying to move them to action and show them that it is not about your intention, it's about the impact of your choices. And if that choice means inaction, there's an impact with it too. And I'm also trying to get people to move away from hearts and minds ideology, which is like, I think this is bad, so therefore I'm okay. It's like, no, if you're doing nothing, you support the status quo, and the status quo is based on a white supremacist construct. So then you are more a part of the problem than a part of the solution.
So beautifully said, certainly. It seems to me anti-racism activism has really helped shape your career. Do I perceive correctly? And if so, how, please?
Well, you know, I've had at the beginning, you know, very much the career that a lot of people would expect, you know, from coming from Wellesley, Harvard, and Columbia. You know, so I started my career as a corporate attorney on Wall Street, working for Cleary Gottlieb. You know, from there, I went to another law firm, Annette Phelps and Phillips, and then I went to Citigroup. And for Citi, I oversaw all of their diversity recruiting for US businesses, and then wanted to sort of scratch my public policy, you know, Harvard degree and be in the public sector. So I was the head of finance and fundraising for North America for the World Food Program, and then decided to start my own consulting practice, right? And so what I will say is each step, going from Cleary to Manat to Citi to the UN to starting my own business, was a progression of me doing, putting myself in positions where I could be more of myself and not feeling stifled politically, you know. And I prefer to work for myself because I want to speak my mind. I don't want to feel controlled. I don't want to have to deal with you know, office politics to achieve the results that I want to drive. And as a consultant, right, like if you're an employee, you know, it's hard to say to your supervisor, you know, to somebody higher up on the food chain, like, you know, this organization has a culture problem. This organization is discriminatory. This organization needs to fire some people because they are racist in how they engage with people. You know, that's a hard thing to say internally. But as an outside consultant, when you come in and you say, you know, these are the problems that I have flagged for you, then they listen more.
Exactly. No question about that. Now, let's talk about some of the most often repeated blunders, microaggressions, mistakes that white people may make at work that expose people of color to continual racial toxicity, trauma, etc. Please.
You know, one of the main, oh, I won't even say main, because honestly, there's so many different things that people of color have to encounter in the workplace that frankly is weathering. You know, it sort of like breaks you down on a daily basis. So it could be, you know, you're, let's say they want to hire someone or promote someone, and then they start having they have conversations around who's qualified, right? But the word qualification usually tends to only enter the conversation when they're talking about people of color, right?
Oh.
Because the undercurrent is that people of color are deficient, right? And then when the conversation is around whites, they're not talking about the qualification issue anymore. They're saying merit, right? Because the assumption is that the white person has earned or deserved their seat, as opposed to, you know, they got it through, you know, white privilege, which is like what I'm calling white affirmative action, you know? And so they'll talk about those kinds of things. They'll talk about, it could be questioning the decisions and the way somebody communicates. It could be tone policing. It can be, honestly, frankly, most white people think that they're not racist, right? So they'll have these conversations with people, assuming that they're not the problem, while they're speaking with a colleague who, in their, you know, a colleague of color who's like, no, you are the problem, you
Wow.
know?
Yeah, this is very interesting. I was very blessed to work for 29 years before becoming a Franciscan brother in a big pharmaceutical company. And we loved everyone and everyone had equal access, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now in higher ed, I work in a majority minority school. And it's the same situation. So this is so eye-opening to me to hear what you're sharing today.
And let me add one more thing too, you know, because, you know, we're not having this conversation in a bubble, right? So another way that this shows up in society, these blunders or, you know, sometimes you can say it's a microaggression, sometimes this is overaggression, but the current attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion, right, on DEI, that is racism,
Wow.
right? Because if you are anti-DEI, you are anti-Black. You are anti people of color, because diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, including affirmative action, those are to counter systemic, institutional, and historic inequities that have negatively harmed people of color so that they don't have equal access. And so when you attack them, it means that you are basically trying to sustain the status quo. And the status quo, its natural position, is white supremacy.
This is sad. It's ironic because with me being at St. Francis College, certainly Franciscan values underpin everything we do. And they underpin our great DEI program there. But again, unfortunately, sounds like some organizations are not taking the same tack and putting that same importance.
But okay, but let's also unpack that, right? So one of the things that I'm trying to also get people to do with my book is to not engage in exceptionalism, right? So even if you're talking about the organization where you are right now, I have no doubt in my mind that it too has problems, right? So what I don't want people to do is say, oh, all of that racism that's happening in the world is in that other organization, right? Outside of where I work, outside of my community, outside of me personally, right? I want people to take an inventory of themselves and their decisions, because, you know, in terms of like thinking about and defining what racism is, people want to think and tend to think of racism in very extreme forms, right? It's the person who shows up at the supermarket with an AR-15 that shoots up all the black and brown people as a hate crime, right? And so that is their what they want to think it is. But people are on a spectrum, right? And so racism is also the person who, you know, engages in the microaggression, who supports blocking affordable housing in their neighborhood, right? NIMBYism, not in my backyard. The person who doesn't want to change voting rights, or sorry, doesn't want to change how funding for schools is linked to property taxes, because they like their neighborhood school getting more money compared to a school that's predominantly black and brown. But what does that end up doing? It supports segregation. You know, the Northeast is some of the most segregated part of this country. So I say that to say everyone should be looking under the hood. And the purpose of my book is to look within and not engage in exceptionalism and start to see where they personally are upholding a system of a racialized caste system in the United States.
I can't thank you enough for coming on the show today, because what you're sharing to me is inspiring me. I need to look under the hood myself and start with me first. So there's no question about it. Now, need you to help us out here, please, because there's two terms. One is prejudice and the other is racist. You mentioned in the book that everyone is prejudiced, but not everyone is racist. Help us out with what is the difference? What does this mean, please?
So the key difference that, you know, to transition from racial prejudice to racism is having collective political and societal power. So everyone is prejudiced, right? You're going to see someone, you're going to look at what race they are, their gender, if they're tall, they're short, you know, all kinds of aspects. And we're making judgments about them, including around race. But it transitions to racism when you think about who in society has collective power for that racial prejudice to have systemic negative impacts on a group of people. So, you know, I can, if a police officer pulls me over, let's say I'm, you know, darker, or they know I'm a person of color, you know, my assumption could be very negative about that cop coming up to me, right? As a white police officer, I might think they may want to shoot me, they may want to kill me, they're racial profiling me. And I've made assumptions about them, right? As a white person, as a police officer in a position of authority. But there is no impact, no life-threatening impact to my prejudging them. Whereas if the police officer, right, they're prejudging the black driver, the brown driver, that could have fatal consequences for that person, right?
Oh.
They could end up shot or arrested for, you know, no reason, and their life is upended. You know, that's an example around the police, but my point is you have to have this power. And so not recognizing the power, right, that these things are happening within a broader society, this is how people end up leaning into white victimhood. right? Like, oh, I'm being victimized too. Somebody prejudged me, or affirmative action is racist against me, as opposed to trying to solve something. Although with affirmative action, the undercurrent is, okay, you thought you were entitled to that spot to begin with. But so that's the, you know, a long story to say, you need power as a group for your racial prejudice to transition into racism.
Thank you for explaining that difference. Now, it is Black History Month, this great month of February. It's a time for education about the contributions and experiences of the Black community. Can you help us here again, explain why it's not people of color's responsibility to educate white people, but white people's really jobs to educate themselves and to dismantle racism?
Well, so for dismantling racism, you know, you can't really ask people who are the victim targets of a system to dismantle the structures that oppress them. You know, you don't have, if you're a person of color, you don't have the same kind of power and influence. Plus, you didn't even create it and design it. To be frank about it, like, white supremacy in America was created by white people. Therefore, white people need to dismantle systems that they created that still oppress people today.
Wow. Boy, that makes total sense. Now, it seems to me that there are some often overlooked lessons during Black History Month. I don't know if you concur and you want to share a few of these, maybe, please.
I mean, I think one of the most important things that people can do during Black History Month is to own their personal responsibility for self-education. So they should use it as an opportunity to do several things. One is learn some American history, you know, and Black History Month is a moment for people to remember that they need to incorporate Black people in what their perspective of what American history is, but they should be learning about the contributions that Black people made. They should also be learning about the terrible things that white people did to Black people, because you can't start doing some of that dismantling that we talked about if you don't understand or recognize the current and past role our history has played from the beginning, right? That the origin story of the United States is one of indigenous genocide, and then it continues from, you know, to African enslavement, to bring people to where they are today, and to understand the link, right? So you have a lot of people who say, well, you know, my family didn't own slaves, or I'm first generation, we just got here, I played no part in that, to what's happening today. But it's like, well, if your family immigrated here, you follow that yellow brick road to opportunity. And what created that yellow brick road to opportunity? It was Black and brown oppression. So you have indigenous genocide to get the land. You have African enslavement to get free labor to build the economic structure in the United States. But it continued. From there, you had the Homestead Act. The Homestead Act is what gave away a lot of that indigenous land for free, right? That went predominantly, almost exclusively to whites. Something like a study in the year 2000 said something like 1 out of 4 Americans can draw their land holding to the Homestead Act, right? And so the Homestead Act started around Abe Lincoln. He started it, and the last land grant that happened through the Homestead Act was in something like 1988 in Alaska, you know? And then from there, from the Homestead Act, you had the New Deal. And the New Deal created redlining and segregation in this country. You continue through the GI Bill. From the GI Bill, when you had access to capital for home loans and the like, those home loans went almost exclusively to whites, right? And then you can keep going from there. You have tax policy, right? All of these things create this structure where today we have significantly divergent outcomes for opportunity and wealth. And that is what has created the wealth gap. So for Black History Month, what can people do? One, own your knowledge that you have to educate yourself. Two, understand how the United States became where it is. And then also celebrate aspects of Black history, right? So you can learn something about a luminary, a scholar, find out all the things that, you know, various things that Black people invented, like the gas mask or the stoplight or, you know, the ironing board. You know, I mean, all of these things that we have in society, understand who made them so that you can appreciate the contributions and the intellectual ingenuity of Black people. You know, Black people, we are not just reduced to basketball and music and dancing, which is a stereotype about what we can do. What we can do is invent, create, and thrive if we don't have boots on our necks.
It's really sad that, in particular in 2024, but no matter when, that people would have these thought processes, that they would have these attitudes. Really very, very sad. But as you said before, this is the way it is. And we need
This
to
is the
then
way
make
it
sure
is.
that
It's
we
like a
change.
cancer, and the part that people will think is probably shocking, or I believe that every white person is racist, every single one. I think it is impossible not to be racist, but it is on a spectrum. On the far end, you have the people that shoot up the supermarket, but on the small end, it's the person who engages in that microaggression that I mentioned before, right? It's the person who is, throws up their hands and go, what can we do about voting restrictions, or maybe they go to a Black Lives Matter rally, but at the same time, they're leaning into tropes about thinking that Blacks still have a greater propensity for crime, right? And so the point is, here's the point. It's impossible. It's nearly impossible not to take in racism living in America, right? Like, it is like a fish swimming in the water. Does the fish notice the water that they're swimming through, that they breathe in every day, that is vital to their existence? Unless they evolve, they need that water. And
Sure.
so in American society, what we are breathing in every day is racism. So it's impossible not to internalize it. So then people, but then you don't throw up your hands and say, well, it's everywhere, I do nothing. No, we all need to take our role and be responsible so that we don't perpetuate intergenerational racism, and that we can say, well, we can do better, we can make better decisions, and instead educate yourself and engage in action that dismantles what we already have going on in society so we can improve.
Absolutely. We've got about 5 minutes, sadly. We could talk all day, certainly. Would you like to share a short excerpt from your great book, Race Rules, What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You, to really help us to celebrate Black History Month and really motivate the listeners even more to pick up this great book? And we'll share at the end how to do that.
I would love to. So this is my favorite passage in the book, and it's from the rule, because like I said, each chapter is a rule. And the rule for this chapter is, it's not personal when people of color don't want to discuss race. And then I explain why that's the case, and I give people things to think about. And then at the end of the chapter, I provide this analogy so that people can understand. And keep in mind, when I say you in my writing, I mean a white person.
Thank you.
What it's like talking to you about race. Let's put this in perspective. Recall life living in the pandemic. Do you remember that haunting feeling you felt that never went away, that the virus was lurking at every corner? You couldn't escape it because there were reminders everywhere, on the news, online, in social media, and when you saw your neighbors or people on the street. You felt a sense of omnipresence as you walked around, always on high alert, looking at others, seeing if they wore masks, looked ill, or coughed. You noticed them and observed how they reacted to you. You were in constant fear of your death. Loved ones may die or did die, and you felt perpetual anxiety. Your mental health was impacted along with your physical health from the stress. You had trouble sleeping. You weren't even safe in your own home because the virus could come to your door. You didn't know if you could trust the government or if officials had your best interests at heart, unsure if they would do something to kill you. You felt powerless, as if there were nothing you could do to change things to make your life better since you weren't in control. You had to resign yourself to your circumstance, but you didn't want to accept your reality. You wanted to resist and somehow make things better. When you tried, you didn't succeed. That's what it's like living under racism every day, 24/7, 365. Racism is a pervasive, invisible force, just like COVID. There's no escape. It's constant, never a break or reprieve. It's isolating and marginalizing. It attacks your life, bank account, livelihood, housing, healthcare, schools, and dinner table, and separates your family. You want the government to do something about it, but politicians want you to laissez-faire your way to non-solutions, absolving themselves of responsibility, willfully blind to its impact. You suck it up. You deal with big picture systemic issues. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Heal yourself. Pave your destiny. Avoid your own death or murder. Welcome to living like a Black or Brown person in America. But with racism, there's no vaccine coming. no magic pill to inoculate society. This is what it's been like since the 1500s. It isn't getting better. There are new strains, new waves, and invisible resurgences, mutating, reinventing itself, seemingly dormant, but always there stalking, ready to strike and viciously kill. This is the reality. It's bleak. When you want to discuss racism, sometimes people of color only want to discuss it with those who understand what they've gone through. Not white folks who will trivialize things, which is akin to speaking to an anti-masker who berates innocent and defenseless store clerks. That's you questioning racism and their experiences. You're the anti-masker, anti-vaxxer in the conversation. When you come with covert microaggressions, overt aggression, a lack of knowledge, and a rejection of facts, now can you understand why no one wants to talk to you? They're already too busy trying to literally survive. That's my excerpt.
That is absolutely amazing. Where can our loyal listeners pick up this great book, Race Rules?
Race Rules, Which Your Black Friend Won't Tell You, can be found at major retailers, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble. But what I would also do is encourage people during Black History Month in particular to get this book through a locally owned Black bookstore.
That would be absolutely wonderful. Listeners, no excuse. We have an amazing Franciscan with us today. She wrote this great book. She came on, thank God, for Monday. She could have held on to all this goodness. She shared it. Now it's your turn. Get out there and buy this amazing book. We're right in the middle of Black History Month. This is a great gift. So buy one for yourself, buy several copies for others as well. Because as we've learned today, the world needs to change. The workplace needs to change. We need a radical transformation so that all of us can have equal access to success, happiness, joy, etc., and to really transform what's gone on for the last 500 or so years. We can't thank you enough for joining us today on Thank God for Monday. You've inspired us. You've really enlightened us. Enjoy the rest, certainly, of Black History Month and continued success, joy, and amazing contribution. You are transforming the world. So thank you, thank you, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I encourage everyone to go on and be and see the change and implement the change that they want to see in society.
Listeners, guess what? That's about all the time we have today. Greg saying our hope and prayer is that when you wake up on Monday morning, you'll say, thank God for Monday. Until next week's episode, have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.